everyone. Welcome. My name is Nir Ben-Zvi. I'm a program manager on the Windows Server team. And with me is Manny Morgia. He's from Microsoft Consulting. And we're extremely excited to be with you here today in TechEd Europe. I'm super excited to have Manny with me because Manny is going to talk about an actual customer implementation of Dynamic Access Control. It's just been a year since we released Windows Server 2012, and we already see a lot of customers picking up the technologies around Dynamic Access Control that we're going to talk about. And this is really super exciting because we thought it would take them much more time to pick up in the market, but there's such strong demand, and these really fit in to many different scenarios that you can just go ahead and start implementing as we, you know, as we release 2012. Now, we're going to go through a lot of things today. There's a lot of stuff to cover. And what I'd like you to do is participate. Manny and I know this very well. So I'd like you to ask questions as we go through the presentation, because that's what we are here for. You know, you can see videos about Dynamic Access Control on the web. There's many of them with many different topics from overviews to deep dives. So use the opportunity that we're here today to ask us anything that you want as we go through the presentation and, of course, afterwards as well. Anybody here familiar with Dynamic Access Control? Okay, so quite a few of you. We'll go through the standard presentation, but again, what makes it special is you guys, not me. I keep talking about the same thing. So you ask questions, we'll answer them as we move through the presentation. What started Dynamic Access Control a few years ago, actually we started in Windows Server 2008 R2, and then we graduated it into Windows Server 2012. What started it is that we saw that there is huge amounts of information that are being created year over year. It was around 50% year over year growth, and it's very, very hard for IT departments and for customers to manage this information. And we also saw a lot of concerns about leakage, and we still see it today, and regulatory compliance. So this is what started our journey around Dynamic Access Control. How do we make sure we can manage huge amounts of information while making sure that information workers are still productive? We came up with these four personas that we tried to build the tool set for. And when I'm talking about these concepts, they're relevant for any workload that you might imagine. So they're relevant for file servers, which we'll be talking about today, but they're also relevant for SharePoint, for SQL, for Exchange, and so on. And you'll see, I don't know if you guys are, anybody here is familiar with what the Exchange team did in Exchange 2013 with the DLP? Okay, so you will see that these concepts are things that Microsoft is looking at as generic concepts and is actually implementing across the workloads. So you can imagine how these can work not only on file servers, which I will show you today, but they can work on any other workload. And we also have partners that already jumped on the wagon and implemented these on other workloads. So we'll see file servers today, but we have solutions for SharePoint that partners use that hook into these technologies as well. All right, so we have the CIO. And for the newcomers, this is all about you guys. You need to ask questions so that this session is interesting, because otherwise I'm going to get really bored as I walk through the slides for the 100th time. So the first persona we're talking about is the CIO. He just tells the IT guys, go make it happen. Make sure we don't have leakage. Make sure we have a regulatory compliance for our data. How many of you guys would like to prevent leakage? Okay, so you're in the right room. And, you know, in Microsoft, we try to prevent leakage for a long, long time. It's very hard. We have constant projects that we use more and more of our technologies that make it better. This is not 100%, you know, foolproof, but you can make it much better using simple technologies and simple methods. Next, the IT folks, you know, presumably you guys, you need to go make it happen. You can absolutely configure servers, you know, you can configure BitLocker on servers, make sure that on clients there are, you know, long passwords that needs to be renewed every once in a while, but you are not librarians. You don't know what the data on the server is. You know how to configure it. You need someone to tell you what the data is so that you can apply the right policies. And that someone is the person that owns the data. So the person that owns the data, we call it the content owner here, but let's say the finance department or the HR department, they own the data. They know what the data is. They can tell you, this data has personal information in it. Please protect it for me. The major breakthrough that we did in all of, you know, in everything that we do is that we allow the content owner to tell you what the data is so that you can apply the right policies on this data. So if the data is sensitive and you need to protect personal information, you can go ahead and encrypt it or store it in the right places. And last but not least, we want to get the information worker out of this picture. The reason is we want them to do their job without needing to worry about leakage and compliance. Because if you try to make them worry about it, they worry about it, but you don't get anything. Now, we see a video every year in Microsoft that tells us you need to make sure that your information is protected. I don't know what information should be protected and what should not be protected. I'm very sensitive about these things. Like when I author a vNext version for Windows, should I encrypt it or should I not encrypt it? If I encrypt it, who should I allow to see it? I don't know these things. No. If I make mistakes and I encrypt it to the wrong people, then my colleagues will not be able to see it and that hurts their work. So the one thing we don't want to do is hurt the IW work, because if you hurt their work, they're going to go around you. How many of you guys have folks storing their data on Dropbox, on SkyDrive? Okay, the reason is that, you know, they need to do their work. They want to work from home, they want to work from work as well, and in order to do that, they use what's available, which are, you know, public services. So again, these are things we need to be cognizant on. If we don't allow the IW to do their work, they're going to go around you and do their work. So the idea is take them out of the picture. They don't need to think about it. We laid down a few foundations of how we do that. First of all, we need to be able to identify the data. Not all data is interesting. And if you try to protect all data, then you're going to fail, because 99% of the data is really something that you don't care about. I think one person calculated that if Microsoft IT needed to actually go ahead and make sure all the data is protected, they would spend more than the budget that Microsoft has over the year. So more than the overall budget, which is billions of dollars. So of course nobody is doing that. So you need to be able to classify the data, and we'll talk about that. Once you classified it, once you tagged it, then you can apply policy to it. You can encrypt it if it's the right thing to do. You can apply the right access control, the right audit control. You can expire the data if needed. All these kind of things you can do once you know what the data is. So we identify the data, and then we have a bunch of controls that we can apply to. And why are these controls important, especially the ones on the board, which is access, audit, and encryption? It's because if you have processes that do that, then you can actually get in compliance. So you can show an auditor that comes in once a quarter, once a year, show him, these are our processes, this is how we classify our data, this is how we then protect our classified data. And if the auditor is happy with what you're doing, then you're golden with your compliance rules. Any questions up to now? I know it's early, it's Madrid. Okay, so let's talk about data classification. Data classification is a huge, huge problem. It's very hard to do. I'll tell you right now, it's extremely hard to do. It's hard to do because if you think about how you want to classify your data, you know, you're going on a one-year project just to think about how am I going to tag my data? What am I going to use? Should I use business impact? Should I use personal information? Should I use what compliance regulation it relates to, and so on? This is just deciding how to classify your data is about 1 year of your work to get everybody agreed on, and you need to go and agree with all the departments that are relevant, and it just takes time and it's a lot of process, and we want to avoid that. I'll tell you in a second how we avoid it. Then once you decided how you want to tag your data, you need to go ahead and actually tag it. So how do you tag your data? There's a bunch of ways to do it, but there's no one way. So what we included, the way we think about it is, you can tag your data by the content owners. They can tell you what the data is. So that's one way. Another way is to tag it based on the location that it's created in. A third way, which is very important, is to use the content of the data to tag the data. So, you know, go and scan the data. Why is it important? Because no one in his right mind is going to go back and tag terabytes of data. So you want something automatic that does it. So let's say you add an automatic process to classify data based on the content. Who here is really worried about false positives? That some data would be too much classified. So let's say, you know, it has my grocery list and it's classified as PII. Right, that's a problem. Okay. I've been working on this for at least 5 years, working with many organizations on data classifications based on content. And my conclusion is that it is a problem that something might be overclassified. But if we let the user then say, oh, this was a mistake, it's not really that classification, then we're not so bad. So we kind of warn the user sometimes, and then the user says, oh, no, you were mistaken. Let me just modify that. It's okay to, this is just my grocery list. It's not PII information. Why am I mentioning this? I'm mentioning this because many people, when you go and talk to folks and say, I have this great tool set, it classifies data based on content, many people will tell you, oh, no, but some data might be overclassified. We can't do that. And the other reason that this is really, 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 in my mind, not that relevant, is that most of the data, nobody will ever touch it. 99% of your data, nobody touches. It's just all data. You can get rid of it at some point. You need to be, of course, make sure you're not getting rid of regulatory information that you need to make sure you keep for 7 years, 12 years, whatever you. But nobody's going to touch that data. Nobody's going there. That data is just sitting there unprotected right now. It can leak out, and nobody's ever going to see it other than the bad guys. So if you protect the data, and if somebody ever goes to that data and tries to access it and is unable to because of overclassification, then you can have processes that allow him to actually access it in less optimal ways. But most likely, nobody's ever going to notice that you overclassified your data. If you underclassified it, yes, people are going to notice if it leaks. Okay. So we talked about manual classification based on the user. We talked about location-based classification based on where the content lives. We talked about automatic classification. There's also application-based classification where the application, let's say, it takes some data from an HR database and stores it in an Excel spreadsheet for a report. Then you know, the application knows this is PII information, personal information. It can tag it as such. So if you have all these four, you can get to a pretty good classification. I would say if you have the location-based and the content-based, you also can get to a very good classification. So you can start with that. I wanted to mention one thing we added in R2, which is we found like there was a lot of feedback around that. let's say I have some document with social security numbers. And you know, I tag it as containing personal information, and I notify the user, you have some personal information here, you know, either go fix it or make sure that it's protected. And the user goes in and removes the social security numbers from the document. Now I need to make sure that the tagging goes away. So in Server 2012 R2, we added a way to, when you automatically classify data, to remove tags when it's no longer relevant for the document. Just wanted to mention that for the folks that already know about dynamic access control and file classification infrastructure. Okay, let's go and do a demo. Before you go do a demo, sorry, forgot that. That slide is extremely important because it saves you a year of work. Why does it save you a year of work? Because we already went ahead and did this year of work for you. So we hired external consultants, we went through all the regulations, or at least the US, some regulations in the US like HIPAA, SOX, and so on. But we also went through Safe Harbor so that we make sure Europe is also covered at some point. But we came up with common sense, regulation-based ways to tag data. And we put it in the product. And we said, you can use this if you want to. You don't have to. You can change it. You don't have to use all of it. But this is the common sense things that we found that you can start from. And lo and behold, most customers that I talk to, this covers all of their needs. So if you just want to start using classification, you can look at the list that we already have. It's available in the data classification toolkit that we published, and it's available in Server 2012 Active Directory, and you can use that list as a starting point for you. You can change it, you can modify it, you can add values, you can remove values, but it's a good list to start from, and it saves you a year. And you can tell your management, this is what other people are using. This is what we use in Microsoft. So now you can start from there. I hear someone laughing there. Is it because you found something funny on the list or no? Okay, good. Just wanted to make sure because we'll change the list for you. All right. So let's go and see a demo. So right now I'm on my file server. And the first thing I'm going to do is show you location-based classification. So let's say I'm in the finance department and I own the finance department, I'm the content owner. Now I can simply go into the finance share, this is my share, go to properties, classification, and I have a list of properties here that are published from my Active Directory in Server 2012. And I can use this list to go in and decide how I want to tag my data. So I want to tag here department equals finance. I'll just click OK. And now every file in this subfolder is going to be tagged as department equals finance. And if I create a new file, it's going to be tagged as department equals finance as well. Simple as that. I now, as the content owner, I don't need to worry about it anymore. Now, this list is coming from Active Directory. It's been defined in Active Directory by the IT administrators, and it's consistent across all the file servers. In order to use this, you need just a schema update to Active Directory to Server 2012. There's no domain mode. You don't need to have all the domain controllers as Server 2012. Everything that I'm showing you, what I would recommend is you have one Server 2012 domain controller. That's it. You don't need to upgrade any other of your domain controllers in the forest in order to do this. And the file server needs to be 2012 or 2012 R2. Okay. Any questions up to now? Yes, go. The question was, can you classify documents in SharePoint? So these technologies that I'm showing you in Windows do not classify SharePoint. There are partners that already do classification in SharePoint. And, you know, the SharePoint team is aware of this functionality as well. Yes. Great question. So the question was, how do we store the classification on the files? There are three ways we store the classification on the files. One is we store it in an alternate data stream so that if, as long as you move it in NTFS, we keep that alternate data stream and the classification persists. So if I take a file from finance and move it to operations, it's still tagged as finance unless the user went ahead and manually classified it as operations. The second place we put it in is in the document for office documents so that it persists even if it goes through email. The third place we put it in server 2012, beginning from server 2012 on Windows 8, is in the security descriptor. So we can use it for access control as well. Yes? The question was, is one domain controller enough? First of all, it's one domain controller per forest, not per domain. Okay, that's one thing, very important. Actually, you could just upgrade the schema, but the reason I'm telling you one domain controller is so you have all the tools and everything there. Second is, the only thing that the domain controller is used for up to now is just to get the information, to read the information from Active Directory. So you don't need to there's no load, there's no special load on the domain controller. And I'll mention when the domain controllers become important, okay? Yes? Yes. The question was, what happens if I change, let's say now, the department from finance to something else, what happens on the folder? So if the file was originally from finance, if it's tagged as finance, and now I change on the folder from finance to operations, for example, it's going to get retagged as operations. But if it's something else, we're not going to override it. Okay. Good question. Took us a lot of time to implement that thing. All right, so another set of rules that I have here is automatic content classification. I'll show you just very, very quickly. How many of you guys are familiar with file classification infrastructure? Okay, so not a lot. I'm going to show that now. It's the within the file server resource manager, we have also a toolset for classification. You can see here the classification properties. I'll show it to you. And notice there's some global classification, like department and country. These are coming from Active Directory. And we also have here a classification rule that basically says, use the content classification method to tag files as impact equals high if you find this regular expression that's kind of like a credit card expression. Now, this is a simple case. You can do a very complex regular expression, and guess what? We also already built the regular expression for you. It's in a data classification toolkit, and when you download it, it's a free download. It imports a bunch of data classification regular expressions that allows you to pick what you want. Like, do you want an Amex card or a Visa card and all this kind of good stuff? There's also partners that help you train the classification engine so that you can say, this data set is finance, this data set is development. Train on that data set, and then use that training to go and scan all the other documents. Data Global is the partner that does that. All right, so I wanted to call out one more thing here that's interesting. If you look at this drop-down, this is what we deliver in the box. So content-based classification, folder-based classification, and PowerShell-based classification. So let's say you have a special project that you want to do. For example, let's say that you want to make sure that you tag the owners of the files. You want to get all the history about the owners of the files. Right? So you want to tag for each file what were all the owners so that you can use it for e-discovery. Okay? So we didn't provide it in the box. But you can write a PowerShell script that does it for you and just plugs into this mechanism. So every time an owner changes, we will call the PowerShell classifier, and that will run a PowerShell script that you wrote that will tag the file with another owner. So you can have a list of owners as a tag on the file. That's an example of what we did for our LCA, for our legal department, to be able to track all the owners of a file on the file server. So any PowerShell script that you want to write, any logic that you want to write, you can use PowerShell to write this logic for classifying your data. Make sense? Any questions? So you saw manual classification, you saw folder-based classification, you saw content-based classification. All right. Let me show you how this works. So another thing I wanted to... Actually, it's not here. So let me show you how this works. Let's close this guy over here. And there's a private document here with some credit card information, bogus credit card information. And if you look here, the properties, you'll see that the classification, it's basically not classified yet. So you see impact is none. So if I take that document and copy it into my public shares, another mechanism that we introduced in 2012 is what we call continuous classification. So as I copy it, the classification engine kicks in. It's not real time. Like I copy it and then it kicks in, and it looks at the file and says, oh, this file matches a rule. Let me go set it as per the rule. So in this case, this file was already set up to impact equals high. One thing that people really worry about is what is the performance impact of this thing on the system. So, of course, if you write 1,000 regular expressions that are running on the system, they're going to take some CPU. But the overall performance impact, let's say with 10 different rules that are pretty complex, that we measured was around 5% impact on the overall system. That means that if you have an overall system that services, say, 10,000 users, then it would service 10,000 users. The way we kind of measure it, just to quickly go on a tangent, is we check what is the, when a user works and works with a file server, what is the delay that he is seeing? Is it noticeable or not? So if 10,000 users don't see any noticeable delay working on the file server, then we say this file server supports 10,000 users. And we have a workload that we use for information workers to measure that. So if you had 10,000 users, then you would only be able to support, 10,000 minus 5%, and you'll do the math. But basically, the impact is around 5% on the server if you run with continuous automatic classification. And again, we run with this in many servers. We didn't notice any. There was no complaint in the last 2-3 years. In MSIT, so I'm just not worried about it. And if you give us feedback that it's a problem, we'll fix it. So, all right. So I showed you how it works on one server. However, anybody here has more than one file server? Yes. Okay. In MSIT, we have around 3,000. So I think we get the issue of if it works on one server, we need to work on the other 3,000. And that's another reason we built the data classification toolkit. So we built the data classification toolkit, which is, again, is a free download, for two reasons. One is to save you this year of development of thinking about what properties should I use, what are the regular expressions should I use. We just gave you a baseline. You can use that. Second thing is, how do you work across multiple file servers? And the methodology that we use is pretty simple. We have a management client, so you don't need to the data classification toolkit, you only need to install on the management client, not on every server. So it's one client. It allows you to have, you know, to manage your staging server, so you can have a staging server with a set of rules. You want to change, you change there, you check that everything is okay. After you're happy with that, you export that configuration, and then you import it to all your other servers. Either it's 2008 R2, 2012, or 2012 R2. And then once you did that, that configuration baseline is now on all the servers. And again, that can continue and work the same way. You update your staging server, you work, everything is good, export, import to all other servers. You can check which servers are have the same configuration, which servers are different, and so on. Very, very nice tool. All with UI that allow, that walks you through wizards that allow you to do just that. We also have reports that the data classification toolkit collects and into a SQL database. And again, that's an optional component, but you can use that to collect all reports from all servers, and you can actually see where your high business impact information, where your PII information is, and you can also see the trends of how this grows across time. So this is a very, very useful tool. I encourage you to take a look at it. Any questions up to now? Because we're going to shift now to access control. Okay, so we got classification in a manageable way. I won't say again, it's not easy. It's hard, but it's manageable. And again, the way to think about it is think about doing something simple. Don't start from I'm going to have 20 different properties and so on. You can always grow to that. Start with one or two. Start with specific departments. You know, get the value to the departments so that then they can use it and it can spread around. People are very cautious about starting something. But then once somebody else did it, it's much easier to go ahead and do it. Okay, so there is one major thing that we introduced in Windows Server 2012 and, of course, in R2, which is expression-based access control. It's huge for security, and I'm going to show you why. Today, we're using security groups for access control. We're going to continue using security groups for access control in 2012, in 2012 R2, and 2000 whatever next one is. We're not changing that. You should continue using that. Whatever I say after now, you should continue using security groups. However, the way we use security groups is going to change. Why is that? Because today, if you wanted to create something like to protect, say you have a folder structure, it doesn't matter on one server or multiple servers, that has, you know, a country, 50 countries, so think about a folder structure with 50 countries, you need 50 groups. But if you have for each country 20 branches, now you need 50 times 20. The reason is that if you're in a specific country, in a specific branch, you need a group for that. Okay? And if you also have 100 customers for each branch, you're now in a 100,000 groups situation. How many folks have more than 100,000 security groups? How many folks have more than a million security groups? Okay, I see at least one there. In Microsoft, we have more than a million. So we actually had worked on a project with the finance team, with the, sorry, global payroll team within finance. They had 90,000 ACLs on a file server that had only 200 gigabytes on it. And they needed to show compliance how people can access the data, the global payroll data, on this file server. Now imagine showing someone that the that you're adhering to compliance with 90,000 different access conditions. Now, that's impossible. and we fixed that. So let me show you how we fixed it. From 100,000 security groups, I can get to 170 groups if I just use end conditions in my ACLs. So instead of saying the user needs to be in a security group that belongs to, you know, US, Seattle branch, and Contoso customer, I'm just saying if the user is in the US and the user is in Seattle and the user has Contoso as a customer, allow them access. So this gets me from 100,000 to 170. You can do that today on all your Server 2012 or Windows 8 clients. It's as simple as that. Okay. We got from 90,000 ACLs to 30 ACLs with a global payroll team. Okay, so this is a done deal to use that technology. We didn't talk about user claims, device claim, anything else. Just local ACLs on Server 2012 using end conditions. All right. But of course, we couldn't just use security groups. We wanted to prepare the system. If we did, this is a huge investment, by the way. It's internal in Windows. All the Windows security has been modified to support this. And you can use any Windows API now, security API, to use this kind of access condition. We didn't touch the file system itself. It's all below the file system. So once we did that, we thought about, okay, how are we taking that a step further so that it works for the next 10 years? And we came up with a model of access control is based on who the user is, so which security groups is in, but also we added the concept of claims. So you can have claims for users in Active Directory that tells you things like the user is from example, which department is from, what's his clearance level, and so on. We'll see in a second why it's important. But security groups and claims are very, very much the same. If you want to have a claim in Active Directory that describes the user, you have to make sure that that claim is as secure as any security group. That the process that provisions that claim is as secure as the security, as a security group. So you can't just have, say, you know, title and use it as a claim, because if I can change my title, then I can get access to stuff if you use security based on that. So in Microsoft, you can use only one claim in our Active Directory. There's folks that are much more principled about their Active Directory user attributes. But in Microsoft, we could only use whether the user is a full-time employee or not. And we had some rules based on whether the user is a full-time employee or not. So you can still use security groups, but you can also use claims. This is who the user is. Then there's what the device is. Is the device a managed device or non-managed device? Is it from the finance department or not? And last but not least, we have the resource property, which is the tagging on the files. So now I can actually have an access policy that says, if the file is high impact, allow access only if the user department is the same as the file department. So why is it important to use the user claim here? Because if I have 500 departments, I just need one rule for it. I don't need 500 rules. I don't need to say if the user is from the finance department and the file is from the finance department. I can just say user department equals file department. But you have to make sure the department never changes on the user. Because once it changes, if you use this, it doesn't have access. Like if somebody decided to change it from finance to, you know, really good finance, access is gone. So that's the word of caution of using user claims. You have to be very principled about it. It's just like security groups. It just allows you more flexibility in conditions where you want to compare stuff. You know, and device is a managed device. Again, very important. Now, to use device claims, you have to use Windows 8 clients. Okay, it doesn't mean that you can't use Windows 7, but if the condition has a device claim in it, Windows 7 would not be able to access the data, which is kind of like, it's fine, you know. It's, if you wanted only Windows 8 devices that are managed to access the data, you're good to go. To use user claims, you don't need Windows. You can use Linux or iPad. Doesn't matter. Because the server is doing the work for you. If you go to the server, if a user tries to access the server, the Windows 1012 file server, and that server needs user claims. The server will go to Active Directory and get the claims for the user because he knows who the user is, so we can get the claim for him. Okay? This is the case when you need more than one domain controller, because the servers would go to the user's domain controllers and get the user claims for them. So you need to make sure that you have at least one domain controller in each of the user domains to go and get the user claims for. All right, so user claims you can use no limit on the client OS. Device claims you use if you have Windows 8. The way we implemented user claims and device claims together, by the way, device claims can also be security groups that the device belongs to. So you don't need to use claims. You can just use security groups on the devices. An example for usage of this is, let's say I only want customers to access specific data or users to access specific data only through virtual machines servers, through VDI deployments or RDS deployment. I can take all the RDS servers and put them in a security group and then allow access only to devices that are from that security group to this data. So the clients, you can use any client, only if the user logs in, you know, RDP is into the RDS server, then he can access the data. If he doesn't, then he cannot. All right, so the way we implement it, we upgraded Kerberos to use compound identity. So when the user is using Windows 8, is actually getting in his token, in the Kerberos token, he gets both the user information and the device information, the same token, and he presents that token to the file server. All right. Any questions? By the way, Kerberos token size is not bigger. The reason it's not, of course, it's bigger if you add more claims or more security groups, right? It's going to grow bigger. But we added some compression technologies in Server 2012 to reduce the size. And we also believe that with the end conditions, eventually you're going to get to much, much less security groups for the user, so you're going to have the Kerberos size go considerably lower. It's not easy. It's going to take time, but yes. So the question was, does the security for the device, the security token for the device increase the token size? Absolutely. Of course, we add the token, the device token, into the Kerberos token of the user, but there is it doesn't touch the limitation of users can only be in, I think it's 1024 security groups, so that doesn't touch that, right? Because it's the device token, not the user token, and we increase the overall size, default size of the Kerberos token, so it will not, if you use device claims, it would not be the Kerberos token size would not be a major problem for you. At least we didn't see it again. Not many people are using device claims, but we didn't see a major problem here. And we worked very hard to try and condense this from the get-go. Yes, please. Sorry, I can't hear you. There is some fans going. Do you want to come closer? So that's a great question. I love this question. So the question was about BYOD devices. So the way we kind of think about this is, if you use a Kerberos token and then take it through ADFS, Active Directory Federation Service, ADFS is going to maintain that device claims. ADFS knows about that compound identity, takes these device claims and puts it in the SAML or OAuth token. So that transferability is there. Now, ADFS added a new way to register BYOD devices and allow device claims on these devices. Windows would not recognize this because this is using OAuth tokens, and Windows does not work with OAuth token, it only works with Kerberos. But your applications would be able to use the OAuth token if it's coming either from Kerberos or from ADFS. So I'm not sure I answered your question very clearly. But if you think about it, old world Windows would not know about the BYOD devices in the, you know, when you try to access a file server, because it's using Kerberos, and there is no translation between BYOD to Kerberos. New World, ADFS, knows about both the old world and the new world, and applications that use ADFS would be able to get device claims from both BYOD devices and from Kerberos tokens. Okay? And if you want, we can talk about it later some more. But it's a great question, and something we need to think about. All right. So I'm going back to this policy for a second. I never said which folder this applies to, because I don't need to. It's about the information, right? So now I can actually have, in addition to the local access control, I can have global access control that talks about I-impact information, about PII information, and so on. And we actually build that into Server 2012. We call that central access policies. And you can have central access policies that are defined in Active Directory, are applied on the file servers, and applied throughout your organization. So for example, we could say that for all information that's coming from the EU, right, under Safe Harbor, only a specific security group can access it. Right? And it doesn't matter which file server this information is on. Okay, let me show you a demo. How am I doing on time? This is how much we have left?
Yeah, we're good.
Okay.
Yeah, that's remaining.
So we're going to our Active Directory. Oops. And this is Active Directory Administration Center. As you can see, we added a node on the left there highlighted called Dynamic Access Control. And this is where we manage the resource properties that you saw previously that are applied on the file server. So all the classification information, all the definitions is defined here. And also, we have central access rules. So I have two central access rules defined here. One is for the departments, and another one is for iImpact. Let's go and look at the department access rule. So the department access rule applies to information that is tagged with the department, because we don't care about information that's not tagged as a department, right? We don't care about the 90% of the information that's really not tagged, or let's say your executables. We don't necessarily care about them. Some people might care about them. They can tag them, and the policy will apply to them. But this policy applies only to files that were tagged with a specific department. And then the policy says, now it says the regular stuff of, you know, administrator full control and owner full control, but it also says allow access if user department equals resource department. Okay? So conditional expression. Now, one thing I want to say before I go into continue on that, it is very hard to apply a central access policy without making sure that it's not going to completely deny access to people, right? And after you have a central access policy, it's very hard to change it because you don't want to hurt the business, right? You don't want to be the guy that, oh, you caused our financial report not to come out on the you know, in the quarter earnings. So, or something like that. So you don't want to be that guy, right? I don't want to be that guy that tells you to use that and make you get the wrath of your CIO. So the way to make sure it doesn't happen is to use staging policies. So you can actually propose what policy you're going to use. You can monitor it for a while, see that this is okay, no people, you know, you don't get people that don't get access, and then go and apply the central access policy. So in Microsoft, for example, we run the policy in a proposed state for a while. We monitor the events and see, yeah, everybody that should get access is accessing, and that's fine. And then we switch it on to actual policy. It's not here, we're not showing it in the demo. I just wanted to mention it. So again, the idea is to remove blockers for you guys. You can test the policy, and then you can apply the policy. Okay, so this is one policy. Another one that we have here is the high impact policy. Just to quickly show you that. This policy applies to high impact, and it allows only owners to access the data. Now, there's two policies. If a file is tagged with the department and it's not high impact, only the department policy would apply to it. If a file is tagged as high impact but not department, only the high impact policy would apply to it. And if it's tagged with both, both would apply to it. And if you think about it, it's a very, very powerful concept. These policies actually describe the business need for access control. So you don't need to think about everything. The business, let's say finance, says, I'd like that for finance department, only this security group can access the data. You can go ahead and define a central access policy that says, if resource.department equals finance, only this security group can access it, no matter where the file is. And if it's not tagged as finance, it doesn't matter for this policy. Right? So it's really a way to get your business requirements into a central access policy. Okay, let's see how this works. So I'm going now to my client, and my client Tim. I'm going to run, this is Tim, and I'm going to run UMI and with the new claims, parameter. And you can see the Teams is from the operations department. So no, department equals operations. So this is using user claims. And now Tim, if he goes to the department file share and he goes to operations, then he can, you know, view his files, edit his files, do whatever he needs to do his work. But if he tries to, oh, he sees this interesting finance. Actually, sorry, I didn't protect that yet. Let's go and protect it with the central access policy. So I'm going back to my server. This is to show you what happens today, by the way. Tim can go into finance. So if I go back to my server, let's protect it with the central access policy. So if I go to the department shares, properties, security, advanced, everything new we do in advance. So we don't want to confuse people. Central policy, and we change that to the Contoso policy. You can see I have these two rules now applied to my department shares. And by the way, you're not going to do it on each share. You have the data classification toolkit that can apply to you for all your shares on all your on your servers. All right, so we got that applied. Hopefully now Tim does not have access anymore to the finance department. Let's go back to Tim. Now if Tim tries to access, he gets an access denied because of the central access policy, because Tim's department does not equal the folder department. Now the access denied is also new in Windows Server 2012 and Windows 8. So on Windows 7, you would still get the please call your administrator. On Windows 8, you would get a customized access denied based on where Tim was trying to access. And you can customize that access denied message as you wish. You can go to, you know, you can send an email to the right owners of the data and all this kind of goodness of, or you can go to a website to troubleshoot it and so on. We're not going to go into that today. If you want, you can check out the videos for our dynamic access control. You'll see all the end-to-end process of how you make sure the team can actually get access. I want to call out another thing on the file server before I move on. So if I wanted to see why team does not have access, I could use this wonderful, wonderful tool that a security team has built for effective access. And this allows you to select Tim, for example, as a user. and view Teams Effective Access. And the great thing that they did here is, one, they showed you for each area where he doesn't have access, they showed you why he doesn't have access. So in this case, the department access rule does not allow Tim to get access to this data. But they also allowed you to actually run what-if scenarios. So for example, if you ever have a person that cannot access data based on security groups, and there's like 50 security groups that you can add them to in order to allow them access, you can actually simulate adding him to the security group on this effective access screen, and you're able to figure out what would actually have him the right access based on the security groups. The other option that you have today is adding him to the security group, sending him an email, waiting 24 hours for the everything to refresh, then he says back, oh, I still don't have the right access, and you try another security group. So this allows you to see what would give Tim access and also what prevents him from getting access. It could be the file security, it could be the central security, it could be the share security. So all this is in one place. A wonderful tool that they built. All right. So we did that. Now, I'm talking about access, but whenever I talk about access, I just think about audit. So access is not the only thing that you want to think about. You also want to be able to audit data, to audit access to files, so that you can see who accessed your sensitive files, you can do, you can investigate breach issues and so on. In 2012, the same thing that we use for access control, we use for audit control. So you can actually audit only specific access to high business impact information, and you don't need to create audits that flood all your event logs. Another thing that I wanted to mention is the RMS protection. So we showed you how to protect the files while they're on the file server. But let's say someone that has read access to the file can just take it and go and use email to send the file. That file is no longer protected by the file server. In order to allow you to protect sensitive information, even when it leaves the organization, we also added the capability to automatically RMS encrypt the data on the file server. And anybody here using RMS today? Okay, so a few of you. RMS, I really recommend that you go see the RMS sessions because they now make RMS available online as well and also available for many devices. So this is something that really unblocks many RMS scenarios. But the main issue here that we wanted to do is it's about information workers. They don't know what files they need to protect, what files they don't need to protect. So we allow you guys to make that decision and protect that data automatically for them. Now going back to my example of me, when I create a vNext Windows document, I just save it on my desktop. That thing goes up to the file server using work folders, which is a new feature that we introduced in Server 2012 R2. But if you have home folders or client-side caching as well, you can use that as well. The server scans the data, sees it's at vNext, and automatically RMS protects it for me. And RMS protects it for all Microsoft employees. So anybody can access the document. But if I send it out, then the person that I send it to, let's say to my accountant, he cannot see the file. So it's not very, very intrusive. It's just encrypted. Everybody can access it, but it's protected from leakage, from inadvertent leakage, which is very powerful. Let me show you a quick demo of that. So going back to, I'm still on my file server here. I just want to show you the public shares. You see that we have, three items here. One of them is the private information that we classified earlier. And if I go now to Tim, to my client, and I go to the public shares, and I have, First of all, I wanted to kind of make sure you notice, Tim cannot see the confidential information. Any reason why he can't see it? Anybody? Not people that already saw the session. Yeah. So we do have access control, right? You remember the high impact rule that says only owners can see the information? Tim is not the owner, and the file is marked as high impact, so he can't see it. We're also using a feature called access-based enumeration here that makes sure that you don't see what you don't have access to. Now, I didn't use it before on the finance department because otherwise I couldn't show you access denied. But basically, on public shares, it's very, very efficient so that people don't even see the file name if they don't have access to it. So now Tim has this, you know, customer information here that's again marked as, you know, it has some information here. You can see it's not protected, it's not RMS protected, it's not encrypted. And if Tim just drags this by mistake to a public share, what happens right now, the file server goes, it gets up, it's on the file server notices it, it goes ahead and looks at the content, sees that the file has some credit card information, marks it as high business impact. Then there's another process that says, oh, if it's high business impact, let me go and RMS protect it. And by the time that I talked, hopefully it already did that. If I open it now, you can see that it's already RMS protected with the high impact tag on it. Yes. So we keep the owner of the file as the owner of the protection. Yeah, that's important. One thing that is really important to us, again, it's all about information workers working seamlessly. So, you know, if exactly, you don't want to save a file and immediately lose access to it. That would not be a, that would not adhere to the first principle of that. Yeah. All right. So we did that, and now Manny is going to take over and talk about the specific customer example. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Nir. Hi, my name is Manny Merguia again. I'm with Microsoft Consulting Services, and I work at the National Security Group and the Department of Defense for the United States. I'm here to give you a customer example of exactly how we implemented Dynamic Access Control and FCI. So this first slide just shows you what the customer environment looks like. There's two separate Active Directory forests. Everything Nir has been showing you so far has been done in one forest. My demo will also be done in one forest. But the actual customer environment is implemented as seen here. On the right side is the resource forest where all the file servers exist. So there's a file server here with access-based enumeration, a Windows Server 2012 file server, and also a 2012 domain controller. Often at these events, I get questions about what about the accounts forest? Does it have to have 2012? For our particular deployment, it did not because we're still using Active Directory groups and we're not using claims. If you use claims, then the 2012 accounts, the accounts forest would have to have the 2012 domain controller. Are there any questions about this customer environment? I want to point out here on the bottom right in particular are these folders called COI1, COI2, and COI3. COI1 or COI stands for Community of Interest, which is really just a group to us in Active Directory. In the future, it's going to become a claim, but for now, we just decided to reuse the current investment in groups and make the customer's deployment a little bit faster and the solution a little bit simpler. And this is not working. Oh. So the customer scenario has one central access policy, and you see there on the top left, it consists of one file rule, which uses one resource property called COI. So we kept the solution very simple as much as we could. At the bottom, you see the customer-defined access policy, which is what the customer told us the data had to be protected in this way. So for access to COI information, the user must be a member of the COI for which the data is labeled. So if the data is labeled as COI1 or it's classified as COI1 data, only people in the COI1 group should have access to it. If the data is not labeled, they should not have access to it, only the administrator, the owner, and the system itself. At the very bottom, you see a little note. It's really tiny font. Access to the folders is still controlled by NTFS permissions. Are there any questions about this slide? I'm trying to go quickly so we can get to the demo. That's the good stuff. So here we see a much more complex solution. This is where the future solution comes in. In the future solution, we're not only going to control access to data, but folders as well. So because we control access to folders using NTFS permissions, we still have a few limitations. Once we apply the same types of permissions to folders, we can actually use the folders as security containers that could be moved around throughout the file system, rather than being stuck in a hierarchical fashion like they are today. Okay, I'll leave this slide for you guys. It's going to be on Channel 9. You can download it and look at all that text later. The policy basically stays the same, but it's all about being able to extend this capability to the folders as well as files. So let's get to the demo. Am I good? I'm on 5.
I need to switch.
Yeah. All right, so what I'm showing you here is just what Active Directory looks like for the users. I have 3 users in my environment, user 1, user 2, and user 3. User 1 is in COI1, user 2 is in COI2, and user 3 is in both COIs. And what this is going to demonstrate is how a data spillage scenario could occur and how we prevent that data from actually spilling to a user that's unauthorized to access that data. You can probably already guess how we do the data spillage. A user is going to have access to only COI1, so they're going to place a file in COI1 folder. There's a user who has access to both, so they're going to take a file from COI1 and move it over to the other COI2 folder, which the users aren't supposed to be able to access. So client 1 is user 1, client 2 is user 2, and client 3 is user 3. So I try to keep it as easy as possible. So this file here is called TechEd Europe with no classification. So I haven't actually classified this file. And all that's in the file is Hello TechEd Europe. I'm going to take that file, I'm going to copy it, and paste it in my COI1 folder. So this folder now has this file in it, and this user also has access to that same folder, but he can't see the file yet. Why can he not see the file, or she, sorry? What's that? It's not classified yet, and we're using the access-based enumeration. So now the file has been classified, and I used a folder classifier to classify that file. So you remember Nir mentioned folder classifier, content classifier, and PowerShell classifier. This particular classifier is just a folder because there's nothing in the file that would say it must be this other classification. So now user 3 can open the file and it says Hello TechEd Europe. So now I'm going to actually show you what the data spillage scenario looks like. I'm going to take a file that's been marked for COI1. I'm going to put it in the COI2 folder. So what should happen? Anybody guess what should happen? The user's going to paste it in there. It's going to go. Okay. Should the user in COI2 be able to see that file? No. Right? So I'm going to paste it, and I'm quickly going to switch over to user 2. So I don't want you guys to think that I'm clicking. There's no magic here. Okay. I'm going to paste it. I'm going to go over to user 2 and go inside of his folder. The file's not there. It's not supposed to be, right? So now the folder classifiers are going through, the content classifiers are going through. Are they going to change the classification of that file? No. There's no reason to. The classification of that file should be maintained. There's nothing that's changed about the file's content. The user didn't say change the classification. The administrator didn't say to change classification. So the classification remains COI1. Okay, now we can notify the user that they placed it in the wrong folder using PowerShell classifiers. But instead, what happened? It's gone. Magic, right? What I did was I used a file quarantining mechanism in FCI to determine that the wrong classification for a file was, a file was incorrectly classified for the folder in which it was in. So it took that file and quarantined it on the file server. It also can notify the administrator, notify a security officer, notify the user, automatically generate a pink slip if you wanted to do that. Nobody gets the joke. I don't think it's pink slip. Nobody knows what a pink slip is. Yeah. Sorry. I made a joke about a pink slip. Didn't think about the audience. That was my fault. It means they're getting fired. That's what a pink slip is. So does anybody have any questions about the demo so far? Oh. I can't hear you for the same fan, yeah. That's a perfect question, actually. Inheritance. I'm going to talk about inheritance.
You want
not? Don't worry.
Okay.
Nir's worried. So normally when you place a file into a folder, that file inherits the classification of the folder's classification. So if a folder has a classification, for example, and I'll actually show you in here. Here's my shares. So here's my two folders, right? COI1 and COI2. This is the administrator, so the administrator can see everything. So I'm going to go to the properties of this folder. I'm going to go to the classification. Now I'm using the COI classification property on those files. But you notice that the folder does not have that classification present. Okay, there is a way to specify an attribute must only be used on files. And I happened to come across that attribute while I was digging through Active Directory. So what I'll show you is a file. Does have that attribute. So you can create attributes that only apply to files.
So just to add some more to that, you could classify the folder and then the file would immediately inherit that. But many deliberately chose not to do it and used the folder classifier, which kicks in a few seconds after the file gets stored on the folder, so that it can actually adhere to the requirements that the customer had, which is, you know, I want to make sure I classify it either by content or by location or by both. You can do by both. And then, only then, show the files to the users. If we did it based on the content, on the folder, like if we tag the folder, the users would immediately be able to see the file because it would immediately be classified.
Question?
Yes.
Despite the location of the folder, the data would be protected the same. Yes, so the question was, regardless of where you move the file around in the file system, would it remain protected? As long as it's under the root folder where the central access policy is applied. Okay, if you move it to another file server that has no central access policy, then you'll lose this. Is that right?
Yes.
I'm just kidding. It was right. Question?
Yeah, that's a great question. Reclassification, we didn't show this in the advanced classification tab. There's also how you want to handle things when the file changed. You can say never reclassified. If it was classified once by automatic classification, then only the user can change the classification. That's one way, which is the default. Other way is to say always reclassify when on change. So reclassification is basically if you set that, then the files get reclassified every time it changes.
So for this particular
example, if the user wanted to end the state and make it and place it in the wrong folder, and I want to explicitly move that file from one folder to the other and make this file not how it needs to. You can just go and classify it as the right folder, or you can remove the classification and copy it. Yeah. Yes, please. By the way, are you done or? Do you have more?
No, we can take questions.
Manny's done, so any questions that you want to ask?
And if anybody wants to see the behind-the-scenes stuff, just see me after, because there's not enough time to do a demo of all the stuff that's going on in the background.
Question? Great question. So the question was whether you can use Dynamic Access Control also on Active Directory objects. At this time, you cannot. Any other questions? Yes, please.
Object.
So the question was about administrators. You can absolutely prevent administrators from seeing the files. They can go through elaborate steps to remove the central access policy and then see the files, but that would be audited. You can do audit shipping or log shipping so that if they do that, you can discover that they did it. So for administrators, you know, eventually they can take the machine off and do whatever they want, but you can make sure that they did it on purpose. So, you know, as long as they don't tell you, oh, I just happened to click here and see this, I think you're already a step higher than what we have today. I'm sorry? You can clone it, yes.
Clone the file server. Yes.
No, people, so if you copied files, right, it's also audited that you actually change it. Or if you took a snapshot, and I agree with you, administrator is God on the file servers, but at least you can make damn sure that God really tried to do the, like, did not say, I inadvertently went into this, but he did make an effort and went against policy. Yes. Great question. So the question was, if there are multiple access policies to the same file. So you need to think about an access policy as a gate. You have to pass all gates in order to get access to the file. So first we check the local access policy on the file. If you don't pass it, you're gone. Then we check the central access policies that apply to the file. So let's say you have three of them, or two in this case. Let's say you have the high impact policy and the department policy. So we check the department policy, then we check the high-impact policy. If you don't pass any of them, you're not going to get access to the file. Okay? So let's say you wanted write access, and they only gave you read access, you will not be able to access the file. So it's like gates. You need to go through all the gates in order to get access.
I should also mention that the share permissions and NTFS permissions all still apply. And if you've ever used the effective access tab, under advanced, under the security tab, it becomes your best friend when you're trying to troubleshoot problems with access to data. Yeah.
And again, the security team did an awesome job with this tab in 2012.
It's a lot better.
Any other questions? Yes, please.
There's a bunch.
You need to sit closer. You should have sat here. Yeah, so the question was, how do you deal with backups? So, yeah, you need to provide system access, usually give it to some of the backup vendors use system access, which is pretty good, or you need to have access to backup operators. Yeah. Any other questions?
For DFS.
So, the question was about DFS. Are you talking about DFS replication or DFS namespace? So DFS replication, the only major thing, of course you need to have your access policy in the right places. DFS does not replicate the central access policies. But let's say you did put your central access policies correctly, DFS replication works. Now the files will just, all the metadata would go with the files. The only thing that you need to be concerned about is when you classify on multiple places, you might create a DFS storm. So you want to classify, let's say you have two servers and you replicate between them. So you want to classify only on one of the servers so that the other server doesn't try to reclassify files, and then you get a ping pong effect of files getting changed all the time. Does that make sense? So you want your automatic content classification to be only on one server out of the whole replication group. And the example is you have a branch office, you replicate to the branch office, you want to have your content classification on the main server, main data center server, and the branch office will just get that classification automatically. Any other questions? All right, if you want to come see us, we're in the information protection booth, and you know there's tons of information about it. If you have any problem that you'd like us to address, just feel free to send us a question, and you'll find that we answer very quickly. Thank you very, very much, guys, for attending this session. Have a great day.
Thank you.